Fantastic. It's amazing what they've done to this website. You know, we started out so simply, you know, pieces of paper and stuff here and there, and you know, it's really turned into something really, really nice. And he posted that picture, my favorite picture in the world, of the return of the prodigal son. Yeah, it's in there too, if you want to see that. That's in my office. Love that. Love it a lot. I wanted to finish something. I was telling you about the deaf guy that I sponsor too. I just kind of like a warning at some level, because I watched him have a spiritual experience that would like blew the top of his head off. Because when he came back, he was on his way to Solvang to get drunk. And I didn't know that. He had 10 years sober then. He's got 30 years sober now. And he was on his way to Solvang to get drunk. And this is the generosity of God himself, because he went downstairs to go down to the bar, and instead turned into the gift shop there, and they had a book. This is why I tell you God uses whatever is at hand. There was a book in there called Communications with God, and he bought the book, and instead of going into the bar, he went upstairs and had a spiritual experience that blew the top of his head off, you know. And then, but he failed to do something. I guess he over the years, this is just like recently, he fired me, and which I thought was hysterical. He fires the only person he can talk to because he didn't like what I said. And he asked me what I meant by something, and I told him. And I didn't tell him to be mad or anything like that. I just told him because he deserved to hear the truth. Because I would want someone to tell me, if I were that self-centered, that wrapped up in myself, that I had been so gifted, and yet I was unwilling to go give it away. Because he thinks like he comes in an AA meeting and he's entitled, and we all owe him something. Well, no, we don't. I said, you know, Helen Keller couldn't speak, and she couldn't hear, and she couldn't see. And she went out, she wrote books, she did all kinds of things, and made a tremendous success of her life. And I said, you have so much experience. You could go like to Riverside, they have a deaf school out there. You could spread yourself around, be of assistance to so many people. Because as I understand Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm obligated to carry it into all my of my affairs, you know, that's work, play, whatever, and NAA. So, you know, but he got really mad at me and he fired me for that. But the saddest part of all of it was I saw the light go out, and the light will go out. And it doesn't mean that God isn't still in there. Of course he is, and all that kind of stuff. But it's very hard to get reconnected once you get disconnected. So it's kind of like a little warning. You know, you and I, this is not a free lunch. It's not a free ride. We have to stay on in the firing line here, you know, and do the deal. And otherwise, we don't want to lose what we got and what it took so long to get. Rick was just talking to me about something that reminded me of something very important in my life. My mother was 16 years old in South Carolina. No education, no job, no nothing, and I was born. And she put me with my grandfather and my grandmother. And I lived with them till I was 6 years old. And later on in my life, I had a resentment, you know, like she abandoned me, she did this, she did that, and I couldn't see, you know, the more clear picture here. My mother did the very best thing that she could do for me. She put me with people that loved me. She put me in a house filled with love, and that's all I knew for the first 6 years of my life. I never knew a harsh word or a whipping or nothing until I came to live with my stepfather and mother in California. So, you know, but what I'm getting to here is after she died, I went through all of her things. My mother collected everything. I have every report card I've ever had. Still, I have all my report cards, thanks to my mother. She collected everything. So I went through all the, I went through love letters to my mother before she met my father and all those other people. I came across all these brochures. And the brochures were from a place called Thornwell. And Thornwell is an internationally known orphanage in Clinton, South Carolina. And I would see receipts and stuff. I saw where my mother had sent money to Thornwell, and I wonder why she did that. Until I came across one of these brochures and read it, and it said, Thornwell takes care of not only the child who has no mother and father, it takes care of the child whose mother and father can't take care of them, you know. And so I didn't put all of that together until after my mother had died. And I saw that at some level, my mother was a woman of integrity, you know. She had a lot of principle, long before before I even knew what the word was. So that was kind of like her way of paying back the universe, you know, giving something forward to somebody else along the way. So all of that resentment, all of that stuff just died. It went completely went away after I read that, because I understood. I understand exactly. Most amazing thing. So anyway, he stopped doing the deal and doesn't give it away and doesn't contribute to his own sobriety, if you want to know the truth. And the saddest part of it was to see the light go out and see that, I don't know, I hope he's going to be all right. I still wave at him. I hope he talks to me. I don't have to be a sponsor, but I don't know why I'm saying all of that, except for we get a gift, and it's not for free. You have to give it back. And keep, the more you give it away, the more you have back tomorrow when you get up. If you give it all away today, you get up tomorrow, you got 100% left, you know, to give away. So anyway, we've moved up to the fourth step here, and oh my God, I had to really, really look at this. I just didn't want to go back through and look at all of that stuff, and I had so much help from so many people. Clint told me to... He said, get out your address books. Get out everything that you can get out. You need to go. And see, long, long, long ago with Dan McCafferty, I had done some, I'll say, facsimile of a fourth step, you know. So I thought I was done with it, but I wasn't. I had to go back through my life as far as I could possibly go back through it, especially back in my early years when I was just a child, because in our early years, when we are children, that's when we form whatever opinions we have, and we form our MO, you know, and like mother is our female authority figure, and whatever she says becomes law, and then I assume that all women are that way, and my dad is the male authority figure, if I have one. And so he affects the way I react, you know, and interact with men all of my life. So I had to go back through that thing. And I'm telling you, I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. I had, for somebody sober 25 years, I had a lot of information to put down, you know, on that fifth step. So, in fact, I was down on the beach with Sam, and we were down in the marina. And I was sitting down there with tears in my eyes in the sand, and I said, I don't know if I'm going to live through this. I don't know. And then when I said that to Clint, and I said, I don't know if I'm going to live through this, he said, well, that's the idea. You know, in order for us to go on, the old has to die. All of it, every single bit of it has to die for us to go on. And what we're looking at is trying to be reborn, you know, something new to come along, because whatever we had wasn't exactly working anymore. So I got that fourth step together. I don't know exactly how long it took me, but I worked on it every single day. I had a prayer that I would look at these blank sheets and the fourth step, and the prayer in there was like, please let me see the truth. And I was to look at the sheets every single day, whether I wrote anything on it or not. It was the action of taking it out and doing something every single day. And there have been extreme cases where if you didn't write often enough, Clint might say, come by the office at 10 o'clock and you can start writing a fourth step there, you know. So I didn't want that to happen to me. So I finished up this fourth step and I will never forget it. I stuck it all in the manila envelope and I got down on my knees at the kitchen table there in Marina Del Rey. And I thank God for the ability to get all of that in there. And all of the people that had helped me get that in there, because it was all in there. Every single little piece, all of it was in there. And of course, the next morning when I went to give it to Clint, it was a piece of shit. You know, it was just trash and it wasn't worth anything. And I had this guy, Elmer. It's on my shoulder here. Elmer's the 10% of me that's never going to get it, you know. Oh, don't say hello to him. He doesn't like you, you know. Oh, don't go in that meeting. They, you know, whatever. And Elmer's the 5-year-old driving the car. So occasionally I have to take the keys away from Elmer and say, thank you very much, but I will drive the car now. So, and do otherwise. Contrary action here. So anyway, I went on and... And Clint met me at the door, and so gracious and grand, and had coffee ready, and he gave me a coffee cup, and printed on the coffee cup, it says, the old dog, you know, and it has a picture of a dog on it, which I thought was kind of poetic. And it's funny, when we started this fifth step, He says, you know, we're here for, and we're here to admit to God, to ourselves, and he says, by the way, he's here. And I knew that. I felt that when we started into it. And so I started to lay it all out. And I was there at like 9 o'clock in the morning, and I don't think I left him till 9 o'clock at night. But we had lunch, we went off someplace, we had ribs, we did all this stuff, and then we would come back. Linda came home, we all went out to dinner, you know, and then came back and finished it all up. And that was probably the most cathartic thing that I have ever done in my entire life. I got rid of every single piece of whatever was blocking me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And there's a place in the fourth step where it says that I have to write down my most shameful thing, the thing that I don't want to tell anybody ever, you know, and I had that on a piece of paper. I already told you about when he asked me what's wrong with you, and I told him I was afraid, and we got through that, you know. And this last thing, I hadn't ever told anybody that. It was a secret that I had kept for 47 years and never told anybody that. It was one thing in my life that if I could ever have ever undone it, I would have undone it. I would have done anything to undo it, pay you as much amount of money, or do whatever it was necessary to undo it. But it was something that I just always was stuck in my head. And what that was is, and when I was only a child, I slapped a baby. And it's something that, it just tore me up. And I told him that, and I started to cry again. And he said, just a minute here. He had listened to my fifth step. He had listened to the whole thing. He had heard about my stepfather, how he used to beat on me and do all this stuff and blah, 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 you know. So he says to me, okay, he says, you didn't slap that baby. He said, you did, but what you were doing is you were doing what had been done to you all that time, you know, and everything. It's something today that I still wish I'd never done. It's also in that little package of things that we have. If that will ever help anybody, you know, then I'm obligated to tell them that. It's a very shameful thing, and I still can't quite get it in my head. Like, wait a minute, I was very, very young, you know, and now I'm blah, blah, blah. I can't tell you how many conversations I would have with Clint when he would say, wait a minute, how old were you when you did that? You know, for instance, he asked me one time, when I was 65. He said, where did you get the idea that you have to be the one, Luther? That, you know, you have to be the one. You're the one that has to fix it. You're the one that has to take the sickest one that nobody else can get sober or whatever. And whatever it is, why is it that you have to be the one? And I said, I don't know. He said, yes, you do. And he would not accept I don't know for me. He would make me look at it. And we would dig. And we would go back. And then we'd go back, all the way back to Clinton, South Carolina on Elizabeth Street. And he said to me, well, how old were you when you did that? And I said, well, I was 5. And he said, and how old are you now? I said, 65. He said, do you think maybe we could go get Bo on Elizabeth Street and we could bring him out here to Palm Desert in 2003? Because he says, you can not do those things now. You can say no. You can do, you know, whatever. So he would make me do things like that. He wouldn't let me get away with an I don't know or whatever. He wanted me to see it clearly. Before the day was done, and that happened for me. So when we were finished with that fourth step, he said to me, he says, now I want you to be really careful going home. He says, because you're really spacey right now. And I thought, I don't even know I'm spacey, you know, like off the chart. And he said, I want you to be really careful driving. And so when I left the house, I didn't know I was lost until I'd gotten about 10 blocks away from the house. I had no idea where I was. So I had to find my way. I was in a strange neighborhood. That's when he lived in Woodland Hills, you know. And I dug around in there, and I finally found my way back to the freeway. I almost got run over immediately because I like the fast lane. And I was not in shape to drive in the fast lane. So I had to move way over to the last lane, and that's the way I went home. And I got home, and he had told me, now, when you get home, I want you to take the book down off the shelf, and I want you to turn to this fifth step here, and I want you to review. It's the first, the only time that the book asks us to do something like this, to review everything that we've done, to see if we're satisfied down deep and wide side where we live, if we're satisfied with the work that we've done so far. And when you can come out of that and you're done with it, then I want you to do this. And he had handed me a list of my character defects. He had listened to my fifth step. He was taking notes all the way through it. And at the very end of it, he handed them all over to me and said, I want you to take all of these notes, all of these ideas of yours. This is how you've operated for years. This, and you need to turn these ways of operating into something very, very positive. You need to go for the gold here. You know, men don't, male authority figures don't like me around, you know, and snub me and blah, blah, blah. All that. You need to go for the gold and say, men enjoy my company, blah, 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 and go forward with a new idea. And he says, when you're done with that, I want you to bring both of these lists back to me. Bring the old and bring the new to me. And we will do step 7, you know. By the way, there's something I forgot to tell you about the third step. There's something very, very important going on in that third step. At the end of the prayer, there is no amen. And Clint is not one, and I'm not one, to repeat this prayer lightly anymore. Because it's asking God to remove all these, you know, he wound up without a house, without a wife, without a whatever, you know, as a result of saying this prayer, he believes anyway. And so he said, what the third step is engineered for is for you to know that when you're in the fourth step, because everything that can possibly rain down, rains down during the fourth step. Everything comes out of the sky. You need to know that you're in a state of prayer. You need to know that so that you can fall back on that a lot. Because like when I was down on the beach with Sam, the tears streaming down my face, I needed to know that I was in a state of prayer. And that I wouldn't be able to say amen until I reached the seventh step, see? So I created that new list for him of new ideas. And he says, meet me in my office at 10 o'clock. By the way, when Clint gave you an appointment, and I think we should be considerate of every sponsor that we have or anybody that asks us to meet with them, he says to me, come to my office at 9 o'clock on Saturday. And I said, oh, well, I can't come on Saturday. You know, I can't come at 9. And he says, well, how about 10? And I said, well, I'm working on it. And he says, maybe you're not ready for this. Maybe we don't need to do this. And Jesus Christ, that would send the fear of God through me, you know. So I said, never mind, I'll be there at 9 o'clock. So, you know, and that's the way. From then on, whenever he asked me to be there, that's when I was there. And I would arrange that with my work and everything. And I have found if you are armed with the truth and you just speak the truth, your boss will hear you. Like, I need an hour off. I need two hours off. And you don't have to go into great detail over it either, you know, because you develop a relationship with these people. I can't tell you how many bosses I had over the years. I had a guy named Lou Bazzani. He was the most bizarre, crazy boss I have ever had in my life. And he loved crack. I didn't know that. I didn't have any. Jesus. I had no, you know, he. I had offices in Beverly Hills. I had them in L.A. and all over the place. I had 19 stores. And I would come to be with him, though, because we would do things together. And he would, Miriam, come in here. And Miriam would come in and say, take a letter. And he'd, dear Adrian, blah, 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 you know, and then sign Lou and sign my name. And then 2 minutes later, it's like, Miriam, come in here when we're talking, see? And she'd sit down. He says, Miriam, by now you've had a chance to read the photographs that I just sent you. And I would look at them, you know, and I'm thinking, what the fuck is the matter with this guy? I mean, where is he, you know? And I said, Lou, I got to go to lunch. So I go to lunch and I come back. And he had gone downstairs and bought a box of Godiva chocolates and ate the whole box while I was at lunch, you know? So my friend Shirley says, don't you know he's on crack? That's what he's doing up there, you know? But the thing that he loved about me, I finally couldn't take it anymore. I mean, I asked him, please transfer me back to Arizona. I can't do this anymore out here. So I went back to Arizona, had a bunch of stores over there. And but he told me when I was leaving, he said, I want you to know something. I'm going to miss you. And he said, you were the only one that I could depend on me to tell me the truth. Because, see, I wasn't afraid to tell him the truth. No, we're behind. This is that. And no, they did steal the money out of there. You know, whatever it was, you know, to tell him the truth. And that's how we affect people. When we go into a workplace and we have some principle and certain things, there's just certain lines that we won't cross. And they appreciate us in the long run. That's my experience with it. And, you know, another little old guy, that was an Iranian guy, and he loved my work. It was more of an artistic type of work. And he treated me very much the same way. And but when I first went to work with him, he, David Mostamand was his name. And he wouldn't let me work with the other designers up at the, and I didn't know why. Because when he hired me, it was Christmas time, and the store made the very best of everything, you know. And he wanted me to, he says, you go around the store and pick out anything you want, and you make something for me. And so I did. I picked the best, the most expensive of everything he had in that store. And I went back up, and I made something for him. And he comes out, and he looks at it, and he looks at me, and he looks back at it, and he said, you know what? He said, I'm supposed to hire somebody, and I need somebody really desperately. And I'm supposed to hire somebody for $9 an hour. This is quite a few years ago. And he said, but I can't do that to you. I can't do that. He says, your work is too beautiful. I can't do it. So he said, the most I could possibly do is start you out at $12 an hour, And I was leaping for joy. I was so glad I was getting the job because my wife had informed me, you've got to go to work. I am not going to carry this load anymore because I was in business for myself, not making any money at all, you know, putting it all back in the business and all of that. So I was so grateful to get a job. I leaped at the opportunity of making $12 an hour. And I'm here to tell you that a steady paycheck was an amazing thing for me because it saved my marriage. It saved a whole lot of stuff, you know. And he said to me, he says, I don't care if you make an unlimited amount of money down the road, but that's what you have to start at. And I said, okay. I put out work for him. He wouldn't let me, like I say, work with those people up there. He built a corner for me in the store with a working station, you know, and stuck me back there, and I would crank out all these designs and stuff on a daily basis. The minute he would get them out on the shelf, they would sell, because they were unique. They were different. But I thought he didn't want me up there with those guys because they all had certificates, you know. They were bona fide, certified, whatever. And I hadn't. I'd never had a certificate. I wasn't taught how to do all of this stuff. I'm just an artist. I just tell it like I was telling you earlier with Donald Madden. I just said, you know, he says, do it alcoholically. And that's what I did. I would just put stuff together because I knew it looked right, you know. And I didn't have the ability the construction of it was kind of like foreign to me. Like it wouldn't hold up, you know, as well as some of theirs was, because they used a lot of glue and stuff like that, you know. And I found out all that later. I was taught that later, how to actually put it together, you know. But that time, that stuff would sell like hotcakes. And then came the day when he comes to me and says, I'd like you to do something for me. And I said, what is that? And he said, I'd like you to take each one of those designers up there, you know, that I've been wanting to work with, right? See, when I first came to work there, he let me have Saturdays and Sundays off because nobody wanted to work Saturday. They wanted to work Saturday and Sunday. But that's unheard of. You don't get the weekend off when you're brand new. And I never put any of that together. So he says, I want you to take each one of those people for me, one at a time. And I really want them to sweat up there, too. I wanted you to take them one at a time up to the Holiday Inn. He said, we have the police up there. We have videos of them. The owner of the company is up there. And what these people had been doing, see, is they'd been running a business out the back door. They'd been stealing shit and selling it out the back door for eons, you know. And he didn't want me to be associated with them at all. And that's why I was over there in the corner, you know. It's amazing what happens to us, happenstance. If we're just in there doing the right thing and telling the truth and not stealing and not lying and not cheating. You know, somebody in the world today, just because you passed by, knows that somebody came that didn't lie, cheat, and steal from them today. We stand in a line at the grocery market. I don't know why the grandmother over here starts telling me about her grandchild who's a drug addict and so on and so forth. It's like, wait a minute, is my collar showing, you know? But that's just the way it is with us, you know, with people, because they sense something about us. They know somebody different came today. Somebody didn't want anything. Somebody came to give. I mean, who the hell is that? I was the most selfish, self-centered asshole on the planet out there, you know. I never thought of other people, hardly. So selfish and self-centered. Alcoholics Anonymous opened up my heart and taught me how to share and taught me how to give. And I'll be forever grateful. I never thought I would be this rich in my life. I don't mean money. I got plenty of money, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about feeling good. I'm talking about laying down and sleeping and dreaming that dreamless dream, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm in the sixth step, am I? Oh, yeah. So I brought my list and everything to the office there. And he says, "You got your list?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, show it to me." So I showed it to him. And then he says, "You got your old one here?" And I said, "Yeah." And so he held it up in front of my face. He says, "Are you ready to have all these things removed?" And I said, "Yeah, I am, you know." And he crumpled it all up in the ball and threw it in the trash. And my heart stopped, you know. And he said, "Okay, we're done with that. This is your new MO. I wanted you to go for the gold, and it's good. You know, I want you. Men love to be around me, love my company, so on and so forth. You know, women are fascinated, blah, 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 whatever it was, you know, go for the gold." And he says, "This is what you need to do going forward." And he said, "This is an exercise that you can do over and over and over. Because all of the new ideas, at some level down through the ages, will become old ideas." So you sit down, and these things were also pragmatic for me learning in the beginning, because I could sit down and redo them over and over and over. I don't study at it and work at it really, really hard. I'm more inclined to let life bring it to me and let me look at it and then let me get in there and do it, you know. So but the important thing about that is when he and I knelt again, he knelt down with me, put his hand on my back, and we said that seventh step prayer, you know. "You have all of me, good and bad," you know. And then we said, "Amen." Jesus, something like a giant thing like clicked into place. I had 1, 2, and 3 under my belt, 4, 5, 6, and 7 under my belt, and amazing experience. So then he says to me, "I want you to go back through your fourth step and all of that. I want you to pull out all of the resentment that you have in there, and I want you to sit down and I want you to write a list of all these people that you resent. And I want you to put down the reason why." That's all he wanted me to do at that time. Just put the name down, go back through your phone books, go back through everything, go back through anything that will jar your memory, go through your fourth step, do all of that, see where you owe an amend there. And I want you to put that down, you know, on that eighth step list. And when you get that columns 1 and 2 done, you know, then I want you to come to me and we'll look at it all. And he said, "I can't tell you what an amend is, only you know that, but I can share a lot of experience with you and we can weed through it and stuff like that." As a result, I had about 62. I had quite a collection going on because I'm 25 years sober and had never really worked the steps, you know. So I had a long list of stuff, which took me about 18 months to get through because I had them all over the place. And my experience was that I had to go personally and see these people if I possibly could. And some of them were out of the country and across the country. So anyway, I listed all the people and the reasons why I was angry with them, and I brought them to him. And then he gave me a sheet of paper that hold on a minute. Well, the stuff I write down, right here, it says, Rumi said, "If you find me not within you, you will never find me, for I have been with you from the beginning." You know, reminds me of something. Speaking of Clint saying to me at the end of his life, we were all in and out of that house when he was dying, upstairs, downstairs, all over the place, and he got to a very, very weakened condition. And he called me over. Everything, I think most of the guys that he sponsored in this room probably had a moment with Clint toward the end there, if they were around. And he pulled me over there and he said, or asked me to come over, and the cat was laying up there with him. And he could barely speak above a whisper, and he said, "You remember Rumi?" And I said, "Rumi, the poet?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Remember the little red wagon where he laid down in the grass, laid down in the field?" And he said, "I'll meet you there." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I'll meet you there." I said, "Clint, Clint, when I come, I'll be looking for you, you know." And I think I will. I think I will be looking for Clint when I come. Not today. Hope I don't have to come today. Yeah, kind of busy. Kind of busy today. I have this little quote here, too. Of magic doors, there is this. You do not see them even as you are passing through. Isn't that the truth? Oh, God. So many people have helped me along the way. Even at one time, I wound up at a Baptist church over in Tucson, Arizona. And I was so crazy. It was that part of that episode. I went through that episode climbing that mountain. I was in that episode from February down into August. Crazier than a loon. Lockup material, right? And I went by a Baptist church one day. I'd been laying some tile for a friend of mine, and I was getting crazier by the minute, you know, putting all that tile down on the floor. And I just wandered outside, and I wandered up by the Baptist church, and I wandered in. It was real easy to see that there was something wrong with me, and I mean, I just looked weird. I had that look, you know, that crazy, crazy look. Hairs all over the place, you know, and just crazy. And someone says, can I help you? And I said, well, I'm looking for the minister. And they said, he's downstairs. I went downstairs, and I'm talking to the minister. And I didn't scare him at all, I guess. He just looked at me and he says, let me point out something to you. And he pulls out his Bible. Here's again, God uses whatever's at hand. It doesn't matter where the information comes from. It only matters that the information comes. And the information comes if you're involved here and in life and living, you know. So He pulls out his Bible to 2 Timothy, and there was a verse in there. It says, for God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And when he said that, something like snapped in my head, and I left there, and I was okay. And I went back to my job, and I finished the tile laying and all of that, and went on and continued my life, for crying out loud. So, anyway, oh God, Invictus, who was I going to give this to? I was going to give it to you, yes, I'm going to give it to you. I am the master of my fate, I'm the captain of my soul, and that is the truth. So where are we now? We're at that eighth step, and he gave me, let's see, at the eighth step, I did steps, columns 1 and 2. What am I talking about? I had a list of amends, of people that I had to make amends with. And he told me to get some 3x5 cards. So naturally, I went out and got electric yellow. And I began to write on these cards. I was told to write their name and telephone number up in the left-hand corner. I was told to write a minus on the right-hand corner of the card. And I was told to write the body of the harm in the middle of it. And then the minus was for when you're willing to make the amend. I mean, when you're not willing to make the amend. And the plus sign, when you became willing to make this amend, you make it a plus sign, okay? So I had two stacks of cards. And I was told to look these cards up, look at them every single morning and say this this prayer. Please take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it. And didn't mean I had to do anything right then, because amends are a very intuitive process. You don't get to decide, I'm going to make this one, I'm going to make that one, blah, blah, blah. You have to be attentive. You have to be awake. You have to be willing to do what the Spirit tells you to do. So I cannot tell you how many times, what am I looking for here? I created something called a cheat sheet, too. And the cheat sheet, for me, is something that I took with every single amends I went to make to people. I kept these cards with me. at all times, every place I went. They were all dog-eared. The one that I call my cheat sheet, I have it framed. It's in my office today, that bright yellow little 3x5 card up there, because I took it with me to every single person. I was to sit down with that person. The cheat sheet says, number one, to contact the person and to make an appointment in a neutral place, and that was significant for me.